Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
So in the past 50 years, white's relationship to cities has been characterized largely by the term white flight. They were getting out of cities as fast as they could when economics allowed. But that's been changing. As you know, for better or worse, many American cities are currently experiencing a different kind of culture shift. New York City, certainly no exception, probably the national leader. Boston, San Francisco, seeing their white populations increase since 2000. And what's going on here? What happens to those who are squeezed out of their home sweet metropolis by whiter, more affluent groups? Let's take a multifaceted look at the reversal of white flight. We've got Connor Daughtry of The Wall Street Journal. He recently wrote an article called The End of White Flight. Lance Freeman is associate professor in the urban planning program at the Graduate School of Architecture, Planning, and Preservation at Columbia University. He's the author of There Goes the Hood, Views of Gentrification from the Ground Up. And Andrew Beveridge, demographer and chair of the sociology department at Queens College. Welcome, all of you. Thank you very much for coming on WNYC today. Hello.
Thank you, Brian.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So who wants to run some of these numbers for us? Andrew Beveridge, maybe as the demographer in the group. I mean, New York City has been gentrifying for years and years. What's new here?
Well, I think a number of things are new. I mean, if you take a look at the most recent population estimates from 06 to 07, there's basically been virtually no growth in the Hispanic population in the entire city. There was only 927 more Hispanics in 07, I believe it is, in 06. And with respect to African-American population, the native-born African-American population in New York City has been declining for years, and it's only been held up because of the massive or large growth of immigrant African-American population, many of whom are coming from, like, the Caribbean. And so, and meanwhile, if you take a look at the non-Hispanic white population, Manhattan and actually all of the city is in the midst of a non-Hispanic baby boom. And I think the most significant example of that is the fact that for toddlers in New York City, according to the 2005 ACS, and it's roughly the same with the 2006, if you're 0 to 4 and you're non-Hispanic white, you live in Manhattan, your household income, median household income is $285,000. So we've got a situation where there are younger white, non-Hispanic white families who are staying in New York. And this year, the major thing that happened, I think, is that it's been virtually very difficult for these people to find slots in schools that are acceptable to them for their kids.
Well, let's hold off on analyzing the, you know, trials and tribulations of the $300,000 a year toddlers. and look at another piece of it first. Lance Freeman, he mentioned black flight. So it's really not just white flight from the cities. Isn't it kind of middle-class flight, people who could, leaving, by and large, almost regardless of race in recent decades?
Well, in terms of the racially, as was just mentioned, blacks have been fleeing New York City for decades, and New York City's not alone. Other large northeastern and midwestern cities, Chicago, for example, blacks have been leaving those cities for decades and returning to the South, sort of reversing the great migration that dominated the first, say, 7 decades of the 20th century. So in some ways, that's not new. I think what is somewhat new, as you talk, that sort of led up to the or the introduction to the program, was that more whites are staying in some cities or perhaps returning or migrating to these cities. And I think that's the what's new here. And juxtaposed against the continuing black flight from these central cities, older northeastern and midwestern cities specifically, I think that's the new dynamic. I mean, if you look at cities in the Sun Belt, particularly in the South, you're not really seeing that much of a loss of blacks from the cities. And I think you should also make a distinction between cities specifically in metropolitan areas. Many metropolitan areas or many metropolitan areas where the core cities are losing black population, mm-hmm. such as Atlanta, for example, mm-hmm. are still gaining black population. So I think
To the overall metro.
Right.
Well, I think that point also has to be made, because if you take a look at the overall metro, I mean, New York has had virtually a very minimal increase in foreign-born population from 2000 to 2006. I think it's like 1% or something. But if you look at the metro area, it's had a very large increase of immigrant population from 2000 to 2006. So you're having a situation where the non-whites, as it were, are moving farther out into the metro. And I think part of it is not so much that whites are returning to the cities, but whites are staying in the cities. I mean, New York has always been a place where kids go, younger people go.
Right.
Out of college. And so what appears to be happening is they seem to be staying in the cities rather than like chasing the train out to like Scarsdale or something.
Right.
So
But in New York's case, and maybe uniquely so, maybe LA and a couple of other places, but you know, New York as a magnet for young adults from all over the country who want to come and work in the arts or in finance and that kind of thing. But Connor from the Wall Street Journal, let me go to you, because you wrote this recent article called The End of White Flight. What are you getting at?
Well, I mean, basically everything these two guys talked about, which is that, you know, the Hispanic population is spreading out, not going to these so-called magnet cities in the numbers they once were, at least in the growth isn't where it was. And, you know, the African-American flight from the cities. One of the things, there is that southern migration from the north to the south, and I guess, Lance, I'd have to check with you on this, but it was my impression that most of those people are going to the suburbs. So it's like it doesn't really affect the city core of Atlanta that much, as much as it does just the sort of, you know, because what I did in my story is I only looked at the city, you know, I didn't even consider the metro area. And when you looked at Atlanta, it lost something like, I don't know what it was, but it was some ridiculous number. It was like 70. Or actually, it couldn't have been that much. That was D.C. But it was many tens of thousands of African Americans had left Atlanta. So say about somewhere around 20,000 over the past, say, 15 years. And then the white increase was, you know, like 30,000 or something over that same period. So, I mean, you can in cities like that, it's a little bit more of a, you know, clear trend. You know, one out, the other in.
Connor Daughtry from The Wall Street Journal, author of the article, The End of White Flight, along with Lance Freeman from Columbia University, author of There Goes the Hood, Views of Gentrification from the Ground Up, and Andrew Beveridge, demographer from Queens College. And we can take your phone calls on this, 646-778-3729, 646-SPUDRAY, if that's easy to remember, 646-SPUDRAY, or 646-778-3729, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. So does anybody have a rooting interest here, Lance Freeman? I mean, does any of this matter? People are always moving from place to place, groups of people, individuals moving from place to place, certainly in our country. Who's better off for these latest trends that you've been describing, and who's worse off?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that's a very good question. I think it depends. I mean, people move in part, you know, to better their lives. So people, for example, who are moving from the northeastern cities to, say, the suburbs of Atlanta or the suburbs of Washington, D.C., in part are moving because they perceive better opportunities there. Many of the young professional whites who are moving to the city are coming because they think opportunities are better for them there. So, on the one hand, certainly some people are benefiting. You know, most migration is driven by people seeking out better opportunities. Nonetheless, there are some costs associated with that, particularly, I think, in the case of when this migration to the city or transition in certain neighborhoods is associated with gentrification. Many low-income households will struggle to be able to afford to stay in those neighborhoods, and so that can be a real burden for them. In some neighborhoods, and I think this was pointed out in the Wall Street Journal article, And I also mentioned this in my book, there's a conflict anytime the neighborhood undergoes this type of transition from, for example, predominantly black to with an influx of whites, where there's clashes over, say, the use of the public space or certain institutions, such as the local schools, for example. And that can be burdensome for people who happen to stay in the neighborhood. So I think, you know, on the one hand, the people who themselves are migrating are certainly benefiting. Nonetheless, there are costs for people who are staying in these neighborhoods, particularly if it's associated with increasing housing costs. That can create some real burdens for them.
Andrew Beveridge, same question.
Well, I think that one of the things, and it was highlighted in the Wall Street Journal article, and it's sort of been discussed out there in the demographic ether for a while, is that this is a huge turning point where people are either moving in or staying in cities after, as you said at the run-up, that there was a 50-year trend of people moving out. And, I mean, part of the thing that's going on, obviously, is you take New York. I mean, there's a massive new construction of condos. You take Plan NYC 2030. Bloomberg wants to build up around all of the subway stations so that they can have higher-density housing. And, though they're talking affordable, my bet is it's not going to be very affordable. So one of the questions, the underlying, so this is a huge change in trend. The question is, will it be sustained? And I think for New York particularly, that question may resolve in part on how the financial community does, or financial sector does, because, if it turns out, and there was a recent article in the New York Times about Stuyvesant Town, now market rate, having trouble renting at market rates. So you have a situation where it may turn out that, the city life is very, very attractive now. If you have money, you're relatively young, and you're non-Hispanic white, et cetera, or if you're white or black or whatever you are, if you have a relatively large amount of money. But the question will be whether it can be sustained, in an economic downturn.
Someone told me that when you start seeing that there's tons of baby stores around, but when you start seeing the tween stores, that's when you know something's really changing.
Well, I think that really is the question. That is, will they find a way to, in the schools? Because in the New York metropolitan area, it's an open secret that an awful lot of people, when they buy a house in, let's say, Chappaqua, where Bill and Hillary bought, obviously not for this reason, they're buying a school district. That's what they're looking for. They're looking for a school for their kids. And if they can do that in New York, this group, I think you really may have seen an enduring change in the trend. And in any case, there has been a it's definitely a sea change.
Burl in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Burl.
Hi. My boyfriend just moved to West 140th off Riverside, and we're baby boomers, I guess. And
Hamilton Heights, right?
Excuse me?
Hamilton Heights.
I guess somebody else said that's Harlem. Anyway, but it was just an amazing...
Right, the real estate brokers say it's Hamilton Heights.
Right,
go ahead.
Exactly. But it was an amazing experience because we're white baby boomers, and, I mean, we just experienced this the trends of people being... In some cases, we were walking around, and I went into a building, and I said, how's the building? She said, oh, it's going to be fine for you, but... the landlord's forcing us out, and there were signs against some real estate management company that sounds like they're playing rough and dirty. And
so, Professor Freeman, this is not too far from your stomping grounds at Columbia University. This is a story I imagine you've heard before.
Right. Because New York City has rent regulation laws, one of the things that happens is that when neighborhoods start to gentrify, the landlords want to get a higher-paying clientele into the building and, harassing the tenants or, doing whatever to sort of encourage, quote-unquote, the current tenants to move out is one of the things that tenants do. And I think this is what the caller was witnessing in part.
Let me ask Burl, why did your boyfriend move to 140th Street?
A variety of reasons. We wanted to be closer to each other. He lived in an apartment that was in a condo building, and the landlady kept raising the rent, and he had no security there, and he didn't love the neighborhood that much anyway. And,
so he was looking for cheaper rent, but for the other
and
people,
more convenient
and,
too.
Convenient, yeah. And, but for the other people in the building, it's the rents are going up.
And his where he lived before. You mean where he moved from or where he's going to?
Where he's going to.
Yeah. I mean, people have been lovely. It's a totally, I think it's about 80-90% Dominican, and I didn't. People have just been so friendly and welcoming. It's been lovely.
That's
so
great. Beryl, thank you very much. And Andrew Beveridge, what did you want to say about that?
Well, one of my colleagues actually lives right over there. She is a South Asian woman. She's married to an Irish guy, and they bought a condo right in that general area. And the problem that they've run into is that there's been a lot of condo development up there. They're about to have a child, and they can't sell because no one will buy it because there are too many new condos.
But it's funny, I've been looking at, completely separate from this sort of longer-term trend. The last few, you guys have probably looked at them too, the last few census reports have shown that basically people aren't moving. They're stuck. I mean, you could look at the state, county, city level, and the amount of migration that's happened over the past year. Has just completely fallen off. I assume it'll be 10 times worse next year because this year's data only caught, part of the year. And, it's funny because, not funny, but it could end up, at least for the next 4 or 5 years, depending on how long this thing, actually accelerating this whole thing. I mean, if you got a 2-year-old kid and you're living someplace and you can't sell your house and move to the suburbs like you planned, I mean, maybe you got to go to Plan B.
Topher.
Well, they wanted a bigger apartment in New York. I mean, actually.
That's a whole other.
I mean, that was.
But either which way, people are stuck in their house.
I think something else about this, Andrew mentioned that this is a sea change, and I think in another way that's potentially a sea change is that, as the title of the program says, the end of white flight, when there was a transition from predominantly white neighborhoods to predominantly black neighborhoods, in many ways you really could characterize it as flight. I mean, neighborhoods would turn from white to black in five or ten years. It really was flight. People were fleeing. This, though, appears to be happening a little bit more slowly, where you're having the black population is decreasing in these cities, the white population is increasing, but thus far, it's much more gradual process. So it'll be interesting to see what the implications is for this change are for residential segregation. The white flight that characterized most cities in the 20th century also left in its wake very segregated cities. There was a song written called Chocolate Cities, Vanilla Suburbs.
Right.
But it'll be interesting to see if this pattern will result in any, meaningful integration.
Well, in fact, today, Professor Freeman, San Francisco has started an African-American out-migration task force and advisory committee. Mayor Newsom out there. I guess they're concerned about losing black population. Should New York want something like that?
Well, I think there's beyond that. I think there's
an Andrew
issue.
Beveridge, go ahead.
I think there's an issue about, like a lot of the African Americans and Hispanics in New York are either in subsidized housing or in public housing. And in other cities, not New York, New York hasn't done this, but in other cities, like the most notable being Chicago, they're knocking down all the public housing. They're giving people vouchers. The people are moving out. There's a recent article in Atlantic about this in Memphis. The people are moving out. And the real question is whether, as the city becomes more and more attractive, the downtown expensive, Manhattan, let's say, or places like Manhattan, mm-hmm. like West L.A. to downtown, all of those places become more and more attractive to the affluent. Will we sort of slowly stumble toward a pattern like they have in Europe, in some parts of Europe, where the poor are outside, like the red zones in Paris?
Right. Well, Connor Daughtry, did you report on this San Francisco African-American out-migration task force?
I went out there. I actually happen to be from San Francisco, so it was my whole trip home.
Why did they launch a task force?
I mean, basically, the reason they launched a task force is over the, Professor Beveridge was saying, in San Francisco over the past however many decades, they've redeveloped the city, and each time they destroy public housing. So beyond, so what's happened there is the African-American population in San Francisco it has gone from, you know, being amongst the poorest to just destitute. You know, something like two-thirds of the African-American population there is very low income, and that's compared with half, like, you know, a few years ago or a decade ago or something. And what's happening is basically I think they're trying to sort of right the wrongs of the past. Politically, I'm sure it's helpful, but I'm not. But I think the thing with San Francisco is, it's much easier to see in San Francisco, and that's for two reasons. One is they don't have any natural inflow of African Americans. They do of African American young professionals, mm-hmm. but that's not. Those people are basically interlopers, which is fine. They add a lot to the city, but I just meant they aren't. Making their way through the school system and all that sort of thing. And so what's happening there is basically there is no natural group that's going to replace there's no natural flow of African Americans that's going to replace the African Americans that leave to, you know, Antioch or the suburbs or, you know, whatever.
Let me get one more call in here before we run out of time.
My point is that when they fall off, it's much more noticeable, whereas
right.
Hispanic middle class might be doing the same thing, but it wouldn't be as noticeable.
In San Francisco. New York is probably in a different situation.
Yeah, I guess.
Topher in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I have a car service that provides safe transport for kids in Manhattan, and one of the things that we've seen, most of our customers are affluent families living in the city, but we're seeing an inflow of calls from Upper Manhattan and even Harlem, which is a strong indicator of the gentrification that's taking place all over Manhattan.
I knew we would get back to the trials and tribulations of $300,000 a year toddlers. Who uses this? What do you mean a car service for children?
Well, we provide safe transport for kids by providing car seats in every vehicle. So for those children who are anywhere from newborns to 7 years of age, we provide the appropriate car seat properly installed for that kid, and we take them to doctor's appointments or play dates or even school.
So
you
is
mean,
this
so it's
for,
like a black
is,
car service with car seats in it?
We are a car service
right.
for kids.
So I'm curious, is your clientele mostly pretty affluent families who don't own cars?
I would say that our clients are affluent families who may or may not own their own cars. I think that some of our families have cars in the garage and just don't take them out when they're in the city. We
right.
provide a level of convenience there.
And to do the short jaunt
exactly.
to the doctor or whatever. Thank you. Well, here's one more car comment from Stephen in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. This may set up the next conversation that we have on this topic. But, Stephen, real quick.
Yeah, real quickly, Brian, I thank you for having me on. I just want to say five things I think are really happening. You have to distinguish between primary and secondary major metropolitan areas. Primary, premier ones like New York City, San Francisco, Chicago have benefited from a lot of free publicity on television, shows like Seinfeld, Sex and the City, et cetera.
I can't let you go through five because our time is too short and our next guests are waiting.
Okay.
But the one I was interested in was you think that this reverse trend, that is from people moving out of cities to into cities if they have choices, will increase because of higher gas prices, correct?
That and also the mortgage crisis is people are displaced because they can't keep up payments. They're going to be forced to go somewhere, and they just can't keep paying to drive 30 miles each
right.
way to work.
So, Andrew Beveridge, is it just too early to ask what high gasoline prices and increasing seriousness about global warming will do to urban populations?
Well, I think it will push people in. You know, they'll take a second look at cities because it switches the relative calculus. You know, if you have to run three cars out in the suburbs because you're driving your kid around, or you could just call this car service up if you're a $300,000 toddler family. You know, so I think it actually pushes the needle toward being in the city.
We're going to look next at Starbucks as emblematic of this, coming some places, obviously, but also leaving some cities like Newark to the great distress of Mayor Cory Booker and others. So I want to thank Connor Daughtry from The Wall Street Journal, Lance Freeman from Columbia University, Andrew Beveridge from Queens College for coming on and talking about the end of white flight. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
And we will have that Starbucks conversation in just a minute. Stay tuned.